Some people ask me, Shinobi, why do you drink? The answer is simple. I have to deal with all the absolutely retarded Bitcoiners on a daily basis. So I decided if I have to deal with all you fucking morons, then you have to deal with me on my terms. Welcome to Cooking with Shinobi. Cooking with Shinobi is just me cooking whatever the fuck I want, drinking whatever the fuck I want, and talking about whatever the fuck I want, whether you like it or not. So sit back, pour yourself a tall glass of Macallan Neat, and sip along as I cook some delicious sukiyaki or a succulent shabu shabu, and tell you why Bitcoin will absolutely fucking fail if it doesn't solve the problems I need for it to solve so I can orange pill liberal chicks. You can check out Cooking with Shinobi wherever I decide to release the episodes, whenever I decide to release the episodes. You won't want to miss it.
I've got to say, I'm really excited about Cooking with Shinobi, but should we really be approaching Bitcoin development and scaling solutions in order to help him orange pill liberal women? That is an important question that I'm sure the big brains in Twitter spaces will be working on studying the game theory on this week. But while we wait on the Twitter master debaters to weigh in on the future of Bitcoin development, I wanted to cover some housekeeping items. The Bugle has launched an important Dennis Porter facts page to help everyone keep track of some very important facts about him. The link will be below in the show notes. Also, we are considering taking all of our podcasts and putting them on cassette for you purchase. If you are interested in purchasing, please let us know. So far, the only person who has expressed interest is Fundamentals. But enough with housekeeping for this week. You came here to hear the ungirdled signal from our favorite credentialed journalists. You are about to listen to the most thermodynamically sound duo in the world of journalism. It's October and not time to be a gay bear. If you're feeling gay, it's probably because you haven't listened to enough Bitcoin podcasts or smoked enough cigarettes. We are about to change that. Get ready for some credentialed price predictions and expert analysis of the most important topics. If you are driving while listening to this podcast, make sure to unbuckle your seatbelt and pour yourself a glass of whiskey. This is Kaylee Welch, and you are listening to The Bugle Weekly, the most credentialed Bitcoin podcast in the world.
Welcome to this edition of The Bugle Weekly. This is your co-host, Richard Greaser, with Rod Palmer. How are you doing today, Rod?
Doing fantastic. A little bit disappointed. Of course, everybody is a little riled up after the very disappointing Markets with Madison podcast that came out this weekend. But we'll get to that, of course.
Yeah, it sounds like there has been pretty disruptive. So to kind of recap, I didn't listen to the podcast yet, but it sounds like Saylor went on a not Bitcoin podcast and tried to turn it into a Bitcoin podcast.
I don't know. I'm just speculating here based on what I can put together. But it looks like there is the Natalie Brunell of New Zealand. If Natalie Brunell is more of a TradFi macro podcaster, not Bitcoin specifically, but she's from New Zealand. Her name's Madison. And she has a podcast called Markets with Madison. I think she DM'd Saylor, and Saylor thought she had a pretty smoking hot profile picture, so he responded. And he accepted her request for, a podcast interview. But instead of doing it over Zoom, she financed her own flight, her own trip to Miami to interview Saylor in person. And from the looks of it, it was at his house in Miami, his big mansion. She had 4,000 followers before this interview came out. But it seems to me like Saylor just found a hottie in the DMs, and he's like, why don't you come to my mansion and we can record a podcast, which pretty smooth pickup line if you ask me. However, the controversy, there's a few of them. Michael Saylor said that rich people, sophisticated investors, that they should buy MicroStrategy stock or MicroStrategy bonds instead of holding Bitcoin in cold storage on their cold card. And he called, he said people who care about self-custody and P2P Bitcoin transactions, they are paranoid crypto anarchists, which pissed off a lot of people because we're paranoid Bitcoin anarchists. Obviously, it feels like 2024 having to remind people it's Bitcoin, not crypto. But yeah, like some people were mad he said crypto. And they were mad about a few other things about what he said. He dismissed the threat of a 6102 executive order to seize private keys. But I tweeted about this morning. If a pretty girl DMs you and asks to put a camera in your face and asks you how do you personally avoid paying your taxes and how do you protect your Bitcoin from executive order 6102s, if you're smart, you just smile and you tell her how much you value compliance. You pretend you're at a PodConf organization, like some kind of PodConf, like a compliant conference. I think Saylor was just podcasting adversarially. I think that he wanted to meet this hot babe in his DMs, but he was being careful. He didn't want to compromise himself. He didn't want to compromise his offset.
Yeah. I mean, I think he brought up this really important point, which is Bitcoin, not crypto. There's this long story tradition of people referring to themselves as crypto anarchists. And, it started prior to Bitcoin's existence. So before people knew that it was Bitcoin, not crypto. And so I think it's time for people to update, their philosophy name, if that makes sense, to reflect that Bitcoin has already won and that crypto's shit coins.
Yeah, I think you just said crypto anarchist because, whenever you're on a first podcast interview or a date with a chick, sometimes you just want to impress her and let her know that, some of the OG, sometimes people talk about the old movies they've seen that that girl might not have heard of. Well, saying crypto anarchist is like letting her know, I'm a real cypherpunk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like the indie bands that you listen to that nobody's ever heard of.
Right, right. Like I like Shinobi. He likes to pass lyrics and Spotify links to old punk bands, old indie hip hop, independent artists. I don't think any of his female followers know who any of those bands are, but at least they know he's got esoteric musical tastes.
Yeah, I mean, there's this type of individual that exists that they listen to music that nobody else listens to. And then the second that somebody else listens to the music that they listen to, they have to find different music because it's not cool anymore.
Right. Right. Like this is like, people like Vlad Costia and so many other, super hardcore guys on Twitter. They liked Bitcoin until it became mainstream. And as soon as it became mainstream, it's stupid. They don't like it anymore. It's popular. They've got to find the next indie thing to only they can like it and be, so they can feel like they discovered it when they tell their friends.
Well, that's pretty interesting. So I just looked up this lady who posted the interview, the Madison Ridey. I don't know how you pronounce the name in Australian. But I wonder if she kind of looks like the Australian breakdancer lady.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was thinking as well. I mean, it might be the same person.
That would be pretty wild. So, for listeners who don't understand, what we're talking about, there was, there's this thing called the Olympics, which is essentially a big globalist circle jerk where a bunch of athletes from all over the world get together and compete, and one of the competitions of this event is who can spoof a drug test the best. And so there's this lady from Australia that was a breakdancer that, you know, many thought like she cheated her way to the position because she was not very good at breakdancing. And she became kind of a global phenomenon. And, you know, people were giving her a real hard time. And I don't really understand because, you know, I think she was just trying to fake it until she made it, you know?
The Olympics is like basically status sports ball. And like when it comes to like basketball or track and field, those are pretty easy. You find the fastest, tallest people and you just put them out there and you let them, you know, follow the rules. You let the incentives play themselves out. But some of it's a little bit more subjective. So like the status breakdancers it's like you would expect. If you go to the DMV, the efficiency, professionalism at the DMV, you know, it's terrible. You'd be like, who hired these idiots? When you get to like status breakdancing, it's the best, you know, it's the best PhD government breakdancers. That's, you know, that's what you kind of get when you have to play status sports ball. But Shinobi, he had a very emotional reaction to the Markets with Madison podcast last night. And he said, Sailor is a fucking spook. What's your reaction to that? Or have we decided if Sailor a spook or is the Sailor a double agent posing as a spook trying to help?
Well, there's this rumor that he's gay. And okay. I think we need to confirm.
Where does that rumor come from? Do you know? Where did that originate? Or what is the, yeah.
I mean, it's hard to say, you know, because theoretically, if he was gay, he'd probably try to suppress that information. You know what I mean? Because, like, you know, he would have a hard time on podcasts and in conferences, you know, if everybody walking by him or every time he tried to talk, somebody just responded and said, huh, gay? You know, so
right,
like,
right.
And it just has to do with the community that, you know, he's trying to cater to. You know, like, people wouldn't buy as much MicroStrategy stock if they found out he was gay.
Has anybody tried to, you know, so the Satoshi documentary on HBO, the documentary filmmaker knew that Adam Back and Peter Todd would never genuinely answer a question like, are you Satoshi? So he just asked them in multiple different scenarios, in multiple different contexts, together and alone. And he just focused on how they reacted and let the audience decide. Do you think that a podcaster should ask Michael Saylor if he thinks Lynn Alden is hot and just watch his reaction to determine if he's straight or not?
That's such a great way to figure out if somebody's gay. It's like the best way. Like, if you don't think that Lynn Alden's hot, you're probably gay.
Exactly.
That's absolutely brilliant. I mean, so this is kind of, you know, what people need to understand is journalists for a very long time have been working on ways to determine what is reality, what is truth.
Right.
We don't have polygraph tests. We don't believe in pseudoscience. Like, polygraph tests is kind of like chain analysis for trying to determine the truth, where it's essentially just like made up nonsense. But we can ask difficult questions like that to essentially gauge people's responses.
Right, and you have to be very careful, and you have to use you have to adversarial journalist in these situations, because if you do it wrong, like Gawker, and you out Peter Thiel, SK, they got sued into oblivion. I had to go out of business, and the people just trying to avoid being sued out of business. So it's not as easy as just, you know, digging up dirt. In publishing the evidence, we have to find a way to get the individual to answer the question truthfully themselves and just use that reaction as a guide.
But yeah, essentially, like, the, I don't know where the origin of the rumor started from, you know, and that's probably one of the problems with the internet is it's hard to determine where that came from. Like, maybe it came from a private Telegram chat. Maybe it came from, you know, somebody's revelations at a conference.
A yacht party. Yeah. Some activities on a yacht party.
Yeah, I mean, he shows up to the Swan Sex Cult, and instead of, you know, going after some of the lovely ladies that were provided there, he chooses a dude, you know, who knows? Or, you know, it could just be that, you know, people assume that he's gay because somebody, like, he told somebody that he worked for a federal agency or somehow affiliated with the feds.
That's, yeah, right. Okay. So that's the spout angle here is people is basically, I guess, the way I would put it, until we have proof, I think that, you know, speculating or hinting about Michael Saylor being a federal agent is homophobic, because that's why they're doing it. It's a homophobic dog whistle. They don't want to use homophobic slurs or be seen as intolerant, because that's how you kind of get banned from Bitcoin podcasts. But if you call somebody a fed, then, you know, you're doing the dog whistle. You're getting the same reaction without having to say it.
There's also another theory that that Saylor is just cosplaying as a fed because Halloween's coming up, and he's essentially dressing up as a fed publicly.
Right. Halloween is, I mean, everybody knows it is a spooky holiday, and some people just have different interpretations of spooks, ghosts, feds, CIA agents, all of those are scary. So, you know, he's just, you know, he might be LARPing like everybody else on Twitter.
So, you know, say if you're a meetup organizer and you don't want any federal agents to participate in the meetup, does that make you homophobic?
Well, it's hard to deny that is probably part of your motivation. There's a lot of people who, they are a little unsure of their personal identity. Maybe they are worried that, you know, they might say something like, I don't have a problem with feds as long as they don't try to convert me to be a fed. Mm-hmm. Some of those people might be worried that if a fed tried to recruit them, that they would like to try out being a fed. Mm-hmm. Some people experiment with being feds. You know, like, some people experiment with, like, women. They'll make out with each other in college, and, you know, some young men will enlist in the military to experiment with being a fed. And some of them like it, some of them don't.
Well, I think there's a serious issue, which is, you know, if the Bitcoin community continues to and chooses to be homophobic, it's going to be much more difficult to present the idea to everyone that Bitcoin has already won, right?
Yes, right, right. That hinders mass adoption for sure.
Like, if we're really, you know, going to believe that Bitcoin, or if people are going to believe that Bitcoin is for everyone, then if, like, Bitcoin homophobia.
If Bitcoin is for everyone, or if Bitcoin is for anyone, that includes feds, whether you liked it or not. There's nothing we can do about that.
So this puts the Bitcoin anarchists in a pretty difficult position, which is that, like, you know, they don't like statism, they don't like status, but if you're not going to be tolerant of people with different political views, and it inherently means you're homophobic, and that's not good for Bitcoin.
No.
You know, like, what do you do with that? Like, do you have to change your political views to be more tolerant, or Like, how do you handle that? How do you it's handle not, like believing what you believe?
It's not just enough to be. I mean, do we have a, I guess for lack of a better term, we'll use homophobic to refer to people who are anti-fed. It's not just enough to be not be homophobic. You have to be anti-homophobic. You have to actively do the emotional labor of not being prejudiced against people just because they have different political views than you, just because somebody believes that it's important to vote and that it's important to follow the rules of democracy and it's important to pay your taxes. You can't discriminate against people just because they have those beliefs. That is against the Bitcoin or ethos.
So, like, how do you prove that you're not homophobic? I guess that's like one of the really important questions. Like, do you have to, like, how do you prove that you're an inclusive person to build that credibility? Do you have to, like, engage in homosexual, like, do you have to go and, like, make out with a dude? Is that like how you prove it, or
you can prove that you can prove it by buying shares of our strategy? You're putting your money where your mouth is. You are essentially saying, without actually sucking a dick, you're doing that metaphorically by putting your time and your energy, monetized time and energy, into, you know, the regulated stock market. And that's you're proving, hey, I am not homophobic.
Well, one of my fears is that, you know, in this community, there's a lot of Bitcoin anarchists, right? And they don't believe in paying taxes, partially because they can't afford to pay taxes. They don't make enough money to afford to pay taxes.
Right.
It's like a very like privileged position to be able to say, hey, I can afford to pay taxes in our society today. And like Gladstein talks about this all the time, you know, about like how Westerners need to check their financial privilege because, you know, many people in the West can afford to pay taxes, whereas a lot of people in the global South can't. They don't want to buy MicroStrategy. So like they inevitably cannot prove that they're not homophobic.
That's a real problem. You know, one of the things that Saylor was accused of in this Markets of Madison interview was saying he's pumping his bag, saying that he used people like NVK, the guy at C-Tiner, and others, they're saying that they stir up this FUD, this anxiety over government confiscation, banning Bitcoin and stealing it from individual holders. He says they've drawn that up so that they can generate demand for their products. And he was basically shilling his MicroStrategy bags, his product. And I think that's what some of these Bitcoin anarchists, what they do is they can't afford to pay taxes. So they're kind of shilling the strategy, the politics, the ideology of what benefits them personally, instead of thinking about people who do pay their taxes and can afford to pay their taxes. They might not necessarily identify with this anarchist ideology.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like Saylor's in a really difficult position, you know, because he's having to operate and sell a product in a community that has expressed very high levels of homophobia. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so if he is a gay man, it just puts him in a weird position to essentially like be in a community that doesn't accept him for who he is.
Right. Put yourself in his shoes for a moment, mm-hmm. and think about you are going into your job or your family Thanksgiving or your friend group. And you are a closeted crypto anarchist. If you talk about the thing you share with those people in those group chats, these normie group chats, the kind of memes that you're sharing in the crypto anarchist group chats, you're going to offend people. You're going to shock people potentially, and you might get banned from, you know, like my uncle often gets banned from Facebook, for posting extremely controversial memes, and kind of, you know, they're very homophobic memes. So you can't just go into these hostile, situations and be your true unburdened self. You have to kind of test the waters because the stakes are high. One of the worst things that can happen to any individual is to be banned or cast out from their tribe or their community, because if you were alone against a collective effort, it's very difficult to survive in those situations. Mm-hmm. See, you know, think about what Saylor's doing. He's going into this community. He was orange pilled by Bitcoin Podcast. But if he is, in fact, a Fed, it's a fantasy. How does he interact with people who buy him? How does he not get kicked out? And it's a very delicate balance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a hard position, you know, to go from like the king of PodConf to potentially being cast out, to be uninvited from conferences, to and we've seen this, like Jen Erso, you know, has made comments in favor of gay people and has like upset a lot of people. So like we've seen the evidence.
Right, exactly. Right. She is a perfect example of the risk you take standing up for what you believe in if what you believe in is in conflict with the narrative that dominates the subculture you are interacting with. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's, you know, think about the, you know, if you are trying to, you're an orange cell and you're trying to meet and date a girl for the first time who might be more on the normie side, how would you answer some of those questions when she's asking you about Bitcoin? Are you going to immediately reveal your crypto anarchist ideology, or are you going to kind of soften the blow and warm her up to it? And that's what Saylor was doing. Like I said, he was talking to, you know, a hot aide who had just DM'd him about Bitcoin.
So I think we need to like kind of put in a pin on this or a bow on this topic. I think we need to get somebody, either us or somebody else, to ask Saylor directly if he thinks Lynn Alden is hot. And then we can kind of settle this question that everybody wants to know the answer to.
Yeah, the next person that gets the opportunity to interview him or just ask him on the record or off the record, just ask him that question.
Yeah. I don't know if you had the opportunity to listen to, I did an episode with High Hash Rate recently.
I did listen to that. That was last week. Is that when that came out?
I think it was last week. It all kind of, you know, when you are the news cycle, it kind of all blurs together. Right.
Right.
Yeah, I asked Mike directly. So there's two people on the show, Dan and Mike. Mm-hmm. I asked Mike if he thought Lynn Alden was hot. And he was very uncomfortable answering it, leading me to wonder if he's gay.
Yeah, and I noticed that. I noticed she was, it was, as soon as you asked him that question, he was doing a lot of mental calculus about, you know, thinking, is this a trick question? How do I answer this? What do I say? Do I tell the truth? You could see all that going through his mind just by looking at his face. In the video that Dada said, and it was telling. So to go back to the concept of the show, you were just on High Hash Rate, and to go back to the conversation we were just having, getting really high and, you know, being interviewed or interviewing somebody, you know, that you don't necessarily know very well, that's going to be, it's going to be a public conversation about very sensitive, highly complex topics. That sounds like a job. That was, sounds like it would be a challenge. Was that a challenge for you?
Yeah, it was definitely a challenge for me getting high and going on a podcast. Because I felt like it was necessary for me to do that. So I can't imagine what it'd be like to,
yeah,
to be the host of that podcast. It'd be very difficult, I imagine.
I was thinking the same thing. I think that a lot of people think I get high and I listen to Bitcoin podcasts. So it would be very easy, you know, on the surface to say, well, I could get high and be on a Bitcoin podcast. But that is, you know, that's a very big difference. I don't know if I could handle that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge. I mean, I think you have to practice. Like, you know, it's kind of silly that driving drunk is illegal.
Right.
And I think part of the reason why it's illegal is because, you know, there's a lot of teenagers out there that haven't gotten the experience to learn how to drive drunk, and they create problems.
Sure, sure.
And there's just like a cultural taboo around driving drunk, which means that, you know, people don't think that they can do it, so they try and hide it. They don't teach how to do it in driver's ed.
I think that if you make drinking and driving illegal, then what you're doing is you're basically the only people who would drive drunk, or if they are driving drunk, they're thinking too hard about not seeming to be like they're drunk and driving. Mm-hmm. Instead of just trusting their instincts and just being natural. So it's like you're causing people to overthink, kind of like when you asked Mike about if he thought Lynn Alden was hot, he immediately was starting to think, well, how do I answer this question? I don't know what the right answer is. I don't know what he wants me to say, instead of just going with it. And like, that's how you drink and drive safely, is you just let the liquor do the driving. You just go with it. You put on the music, you light a cigarette, and you just let, you know, Jim Beam take the wheel. If you're overthinking it, that's how you end up getting into trouble. That's how you end up crashing. That's how you end up, you know, blowing through a red light and T-boning another car. Just don't overthink it.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is one of the reasons why a lot of men say that women aren't good drivers, right? It's because women have a tendency to overthink things.
Right, exactly. It's just a natural, part, inherent quality of being a woman.
Yeah. And like, you know, sometimes, like, if you think about it, what's kind of interesting is this is probably one of the reasons why women have so much potential to be successful Bitcoin podcasters, because part of being a good Bitcoin podcaster is just overthinking things.
Right. If you, a really good way to know if the girl that you met and were flirting with at a bar, is you're going home with her to spend the evening, to know that, you know, if you had any suspicion that she might be trans, let her drive you home. If she's a good driver, then, you know, that might be a red flag.
Well, Kaylee is a good driver. And she's a good driver when she's drunk. And I'm pretty sure she's not trans.
Yeah, but I would never have suspected her.
Why is that?
I don't know. Because she's just so hot.
Yeah. So, do you think there's like a certain level of hotness that rules out you being trans? Rules out a woman from being trans? Like, if you're like an 8, you're still like potentially in the danger zone. But if you're like a 10, you're out of the danger zone. Like, what is the threshold?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I think everybody's got a different threshold. If they're 10, maybe you throw caution to the wind. If they're Saturn, you're probably going to be more, there's going to be more scrutiny over your decision there.
So everybody has a different risk tolerance is what you're saying.
Exactly. Exactly. Some people are willing to, you know, metaphorically just go down on it and buy MicroStrategy stock. Some people, you know, they need a 2 or 3 multi-sig keys dispersed geographically because they don't want to take the risk.
Yeah. Interesting.
It's not an apples to oranges comparison there, but I think you might be able to kind of get what I'm trying to communicate there, I hope.
Yeah, I guess one of the challenges, so like, you know, one of the things a lot of Bitcoin podcaster listeners, you know, really care about is they care about objective reality, objective truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so
this is why wormholes are, you know, they're so controversial, because wormholes are subjective, right? You can play out the iteration or the set of this number theory a trillion times and get the same outcomes deterministically that are predicted by the theory, but objectively, sats do not exist. So it's like you could use this protocol on top of an abstract set of satoshis of Bitcoin and get exactly what you're expecting per transaction. However, sats don't exist, so it's a shitcoin.
Yeah.
It's not to belabor the point. There is a little bit of other spicy news. What I want to get to just really quick, I'm actually working on a story, so you'll be able to see that one. We'll publish that one some point today, possibly tomorrow at the latest. But it seems that there was a leaked letter from a limited partner, an investor at 1031 Ventures. And Matt O'Dell wrote a letter to those investors in the past week, and he revealed that 1031 had to recently take a 2.5 million stake in a beef tallow anal lube startup that was linked to Diddy. They had to write that investment off completely, took a total loss. The entrepreneur had a new line of beef tallow lube, much better than seed oil lubes. They're most common, like Astroglide, Day White Jelly. But this beef tallow lube, you know, the whole, apparently, you know, the entire marketing, the business plan was to partner with Diddy and to sell the beef tallow lube to Diddy for Diddy parties, Bitcoin conferences, you know, some of these swan sex cult parties. You know, fed parties, whatever you want, yacht parties. It was going to be a smashing hit success. Unfortunately, with the arrest of Diddy, you know, the main buyer of this beef tallow lube is now, you know, facing, probably spending the rest of his life in prison, or, you know, at least not suiciding himself in prison. So that's a huge loss. 1031. I don't know if they've had too many successful investments in their short history as a, you know, a venture fund. But this one hurt. This was a total loss. And some of the investors were, you know, a little bit disappointed, a little bit disheartened by that loss, which is probably why they leaked that letter. But we'll have more on that story. I don't know if you had any quick reactions on that one before we move on, but I just thought that was something, you know, interesting to share and kind of gives an insight to what some of these Bitcoin VCs, some of the risks they have to take, some of the visions that they have to try to execute on that are very, very rough sketches of what could be.
If I was a 1031 investor right now, I would want to understand when they were going to make a strategic decision to try and make money.
Can you say that again? What do you mean? Like, when we're, essentially saying, when are they going to actually make some money? Like,
yeah, when are they going to start trying to actually invest in profitable endeavors?
Maybe the strategy is just to not experience capital gains, because if you don't experience capital gains, you don't have to pay your taxes. So it's either, you know, I'd say some 1031 investors are upset that they have invested a lot of their money and they still can't afford to pay their taxes.
Mm.
And some might think that 1031 is intentionally avoiding being able to afford to pay their taxes. I guess it kind of comes down to your perspective on that strategy and what they might be doing.
So you think that 1031 is like harvesting losses intentionally for tax reasons?
If 1031 was intentionally losing money to not be able to afford their taxes, what would they be doing differently than what they're doing right now? I'd say there's an old saying, which is the purpose of a system is what it does. And if 1031 is losing money, I would assume that that's the purpose of that fund.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, because while Bitcoin makes it easier for you to afford taxes because it goes up in USDT value so quickly, still there are capital gains that need to be paid for that increase, right?
Right, right.
And so if you can harvest losses to offset it by investing in, you know, different projects that 1031 finds interesting, that's the way to do it, apparently.
Right. I mean,
That's really smart.
It is really smart. So, I mean, listen, I'm just a journalist. I'm not an accredited investor. So take anything I say about the inner operating features of a venture capital fund. You gotta take that with a grain of salt, right?
We should become accredited investors. Could you imagine what the world would look like if we were accredited investors?
I think under hyper-Bitcoinization that we will be credentialed investors, and a lot of the Plans and Bitcoin podcast consumers will become credentialed investors at that point. And I think that's when we really start to turn around the economy. The economy will go from being fine to being outstanding. And I think it will be the result of orange-pilled credential investors realizing that real estate is a shitcoin, stocks are shitcoins, bonds or shitcoins. The only thing that you should put any of your cash flows, money, savings in is Bitcoin, and the rest of society will just totally, it'll just go to me. It'll be so great.
Mm-hmm. Man, I just had a thought about Saylor. So, you know, he kind of blew up last cycle because he said there is no second best crypto asset. And so I'm kind of wondering why somebody should buy MicroStrategy stock when they could buy the underlying asset in Coinbase, who custodies the funds for MicroStrategy, if that makes sense.
Yeah. That is the question that he's had a hard time answering. And I think that he tried to tell the Maddie, about, he tried to give her that thesis, and he talked about different metrics of volatility measures, different metrics of upside relative to potential risk of downside, and how you could use those calculations. But at this time, if you're not a credentialed investor, you can't verify those strategies. You just don't have the qualifications. And so as somebody who doesn't have those credentials or qualifications to fact check or verify the validity of Michael Sanders' claims, I'm going to essentially punt. I'm going to set that aside. It's hard. I can't criticize that. I don't have the credentials to do so. I would hate it if somebody without journalistic credentials questioned my work. So it's hard for me to, it would be, make me a hypocrite to do that to credential investors.
Yeah.
Like Hulamagoo, some people don't like what he says, but he's a credentialed investor. So you have to have credentials if you want to argue with him.
Interesting.
The other piece of the news that I thought was pretty interesting this week, and I wanted to get your reaction to, was it started out as a controversy that Nempole was bribed by Udi and his Ardenal Shitcoiner army to basically put an emoji and a little flag with different colors on some of the mempool features, mempool.space, to basically identify if a transaction contained ordinals, inscriptions, BRC20s, runes, any of that, like we said, the subjective nonsense that they're spanning the chain with. There was a big controversy, and a lot of it was coming from Mechanic, Loopdash, the Ocean, the people associated with Ocean Pool. And then a tweet comes out late last week from Monautical, and he exposes the fact that allegedly people from the Runes Ordinals community have been bribing Ocean Pool to secretly include Ordinals transactions in their blocks. So when they, you know, they don't find a block very often, but when they do, they need that block to be valuable in transaction fees, so that they can pay out the people that are contributing half to their pool. And by identifying very easily, so somebody who doesn't have to have a cypherpunk PhD to look at all these transaction hashes and determine, oh, that's an ordinals transaction, or that's a rune, Mempool made it very easy to tell. And they started to see what was going on with the bribery at Ocean Pool. Again, all alleged, which incentivized Ocean Pool to, be very publicly and come out or being very publicly against this new mempool.space feature that, Udi and the Ordinals gang, paid to have added to that user experience.
It's a lot going on there.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, I don't really know what to make of it.
Yeah, that is, that will unfold. So we will follow those developments.
I think one of the important things to take away from this is, oftentimes when a story is developing like that, it's okay to not have an opinion on it immediately.
Agreed.
And I think this is one of the mistakes like a lot of our colleagues in the world of journalism make, is they're all geared up, they want to have their opinion, they want to have their comment in immediately.
Yeah, everybody wants to have a reaction. Everybody wants to be the first to report a story. And some people think that journalism, bachelor's degree of journalism and credentials means that you are the best at being quick to cover a story or to uncover a story. But also having credentials means that you have the discipline and the wisdom to know when the general public is not ready to hear about a story. It's not ready to know the news, and you just have to use that judgment.
Yeah. It's about having self-discipline. That's what it's about.
Yeah, then your time preference, essentially. If you have too high of a time preference, as a journalist, you will have to retract and correct a lot of stories. The more you do that, the less, the less of a reputation that you're going to have with your viewers. So just as a journalist, learn to lower your time preference.
And not everybody can be Dennis Porter and can successfully concoct a bridge
screen. Don't soil your reputation and your brand trying to compete with Dennis Porter. Mm-hmm. It's a fool's errand.
I know Bitcoin Magazine has had a tremendous amount of issues with this. And they have some real credentialed journalists over there. So I think, like, you know, there's this kind of, like, difficult situation, which is, like, you know, credentialed journalists aren't infallible, but they're still superior to, like, the average non-credentialed journalist.
Right. I think when it comes to Bitcoin Magazine, they're a great example that you highlight because they never share sources. They like to break big breaking news without following up with any sources. And I think that if you think of a really good headline for some really big breaking news, but you have no sources on that, maybe you heard it in a group chat, maybe you saw Simply Bitcoin tweeting about it. Like, you don't have any proof that it's real. Wait until you have a source before you post it. Lower your time preference and you'll do yourselves, you'll avoid a lot of embarrassing situations.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to wait for the story to develop. And,
That's
one of the challenges. Like, I get people all the time that are tagging the Bugle on Noster and Twitter. And, they're like, why isn't the Bugle covering this? And, you know, like, there's two reasons why the Bugle, you know, doesn't cover stories sometimes. One is because we're not Dennis Porter. We can't be everywhere all at once. And then the second one is sometimes we're just, you know, we see the story and we're just waiting for it to develop a little bit more.
Yeah, right.
Before we
cover it's like being on a hurricane. It doesn't start as a hurricane. It starts as, you know, a disturbance, a tropical depression, tropical disturbance, and it kind of moves up to a tropical storm and becomes a hurricane. News starts out as a rumor or gossip or speculation, and it slowly develops into a news story. And it, until something has reached the objective or the conventionally agreed upon state in which it goes from a rumor or speculation to a story, you are taking a lot of risks by reporting it, unless you're honest and say this is just a rumor, but don't call a rumor news.
Well, I mean, if you want to report on the rumor, what's like before you publish a story, oftentimes you have to create your own citations, right? So you have to write the articles that you're going to cite.
Right.
So there's more work to it than a lot of people realize.
That's why that makes, like Turin Ross, people sometimes criticize them because they're spending so much time bogged down in peer review, writing research, having to debunk Butler's research, but what they're really doing is they're creating the sources and the citations that they need to write more research, that they can cite their previous research and citations. We have in Bitcoin, we call circular economies, and in academia, it's, you know, circular citations, circular research. This VOD has been debunked by my peer-reviewed research that cites my previously peer-reviewed research. And you just have to build, it's like a piece of academic research, peer-reviewed academic research. How do you know which piece of research is the, if they have two pieces of conflicting research, how do you know which one is correct? The one with the longest chain of self-citations and peer review is why in academia, that's the chain with the most work, so to speak. So that's that is the academic research or the academic paper that you should always consider the correct one. It's the one with the most longest chain of peer-reviewed research and citations.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there's some problems here because under that logic, Cardano would be the correct cryptocurrency.
Well, that's proof of stake, though. That's proof of stake.
Yeah.
Not proof of work. Writing a peer-reviewed research paper for a credentialed university is proof of work. If research was written by somebody like Bill Cosby, who has a lot of honorary PhDs, who he didn't have to earn those credentials, that would be like a proof of stake situation.
So maybe the way to think about Cardano is, you know, Charles Hoskinson essentially created an unregistered security.
Right.
And while his peer review process discussing the unregistered security is on point as far as what the expectations of peer review are, the fact that he's researching non-compliant unregistered shitcoins makes it kind of null and void, if that makes sense.
Exactly. It's procedural. When you get into credentials, you get into these very high level conversations. You see this especially in lawsuits and legal cases. You can have a slam dunk story, a slam dunk headline, that if you mess up any of the small but very important procedural steps, your work becomes worthless.
Well, it's a really interesting chain of thought. I didn't realize we've been rolling for so long.
I wanted to cover one more thing just quickly. We don't have to spend too much time on it before we get into the biz, which is we just published last week. And if you want to read this, it is pinned to the top of the Bugle's career timeline. It's at Dennis Porterfax. And right now, we have a list of Dennis Porterfax that you can use to share with friends and family, share them at your meetup. Really funny stuff. If you've heard of Chuck Norris jokes, Chuck Norris facts, these are very similar, but they are Dennis Porter facts. I got a kick out of them. Fundamentals from the Rock Paper Bitcoin podcast. He contributed to the Dennis Porter facts. This is open source. Anybody is free to contribute. So hit us up on Telegram if you thought of some funny Dennis Porter facts that we did not think of. So just go check that out. And, you know, feel free to take some of those Dennis Porter facts, make memes out of them. Like I said, open source. If you want to attribute the Bugle, when you make that meme, please do so. But if you make up your own, you don't need to do that. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's really nice. I'm just, you know, so grateful to have a person like Dennis Porter in our world, in our ecosystem, in our industry, you know, cause like Bitcoin really needs this like Chuck Norris, Steven Seagal type figure to help people figure out that it already won.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, people with space, especially, they value objective reality. And objective reality is really just a fancy way of saying power. Who has the most power? And I think pretty objectively easy to see that Dennis Porter kind of represents that apex alpha predator of the orange pilling community.
I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, he's kind of like the Siberian tiger or the African lion. He is the alpha predator for sure.
100%.
Well, let's get into the boost. First one is from Miss Huddle Knot for 11,111 sats, who says, I want an orange wedding like Natalie. I mean, do you think this is going to be a trend? The concept of orange wedding? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I think once people saw the Firstborn's wedding, they saw like all the podcasters that were there. Sailor was, although Sailor is not as popular after this weekend, but they saw that. And they're like, I want that for, I think there's going to be a lot of bridezillas out there, so to speak, who, they're going to demand to have an orange wedding as elegant and as thermodynamically sound. I think any of you want a thermodynamically sound nerd, it starts with the wedding. But I see that as a trend. Absolutely.
I mean, again, this is just one more example of, you know, one of the trade-offs of having women in and around Bitcoin is that they might try to get you to spend your stack on a wedding.
Again, we've said this time and time again. Women, it's a blessing and a curse. Let them tell them without a blessing and a curse. We need them in our lives. We love them. But they will end up making us sell our Bitcoin some way or another. They will figure it out. And until Target accepts Bitcoin, the biggest threat to our stack, especially if you're a father, if you have an orange pill daughter and she's getting married and you've been saving Bitcoin for a long time, she's going to get you to spend it. You're going to have to now worry about, does my daughter want an orange wedding?
Do you think fathers should be limiting their daughter's exposure to Bitcoin podcasts?
Wait until they're married and let their husbands orange pill them. You don't want to spend your Bitcoin on an orange wedding, essentially.
I mean, I think it's kind of inappropriate for parents to orange pill their kids. You know what I mean?
It's kind of unfair. It's kind of like grooming. Let them make their own choices.
Totally. Well, I hope you have that orange wedding, Miss Hoddlenot. I think you deserve it. And I think you'll be more likely to get that orange wedding. The more you boost us, the more likely it is for your dreams to come true.
Right. Detach the attention of some PA important people in this community.
Yeah.
That's how you will get their attention. Whether you want an orange wedding or you just want to show somebody like, you know, a cypherpunk such as Ron Hamilton that, but you were smart too. Well, you can do that by getting their attention in our base on Fountain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So cypherpunk's kind of like an interesting term because it kind of suggests like being punk is kind of about not following the rules. It's about being non-compliant. So if you're compliant, you kind of rule yourself out of being a cypherpunk in many ways, right? So I wonder if there's like a term that we could come up with for compliance cypherpunks.
That's a good question. I would maybe put a spin on that and suggest that like a credentialed journalist who knows, has discipline and time preference to know when to break a story and when not to, that a cypherpunk knows just being non-compliant for the sake of being non-compliant is potentially counterproductive. But picking and choosing your battles and being non-compliant where it can be, it can make the most difference and where it can be the most productive use of clients. And then being compliant where it doesn't actually affect you. You don't care if you comply in that situation. It's easier to be compliant in that situation without any benefits, discretionary cypherpunk compliance.
I think that a good term for it would be being called cypherpop.
Cypherpop. Okay. I like that.
If it was a genre of music, I would call it cypherpop.
Like Green Day was punk for like an album or two, and then they became pop. So they're kind of like the, it'd be like being green, like a compliant cypherpunk would be like Green Day. The band Green Day. Okay.
I feel, well, you know what's kind of crazy about Green Day is you know, for listeners, if you want to feel old, they're starting to play Green Day on classic rock music stations on the radio.
That's crazy.
Yeah. We're at that point.
Yeah, like Rage Against the Machine is another example of a punk gone pop, gone compliant, artist band. If you listen to that music and, you know, in the 90s, and then you listen to what those the members of that band say today, you can totally see that transition.
Yeah. Another good one is The Offspring. Offspring is extremely cypherpop.
Right, like "Pay Fly for a White Guy for Harris" is the song that they should put out today. Yeah, like Dennis Porter is a good example of the guy who's "Pretty Fly for a White Guy for Harris."
You know that I heard a rumor that Mike Brock is the leader of White Guys for Harris.
Well, yeah, I saw that, and in hindsight, it seems pretty obvious now. That guy's got something going. I think Ozempic made him retarded.
Ozempic did?
Yeah, I think so. If you see any of his recent interviews or his profile picture on Twitter compared to his the profile picture they used for his last What They Pointed podcast episode, he lost like 70 or 80 pounds really quickly with zero muscle mass. So I think it was Ozempic that he was taking, and his opinions, and he was when he went on Peter McCormack, most of his episodes, he was pretty, his politics were pretty right wing, and now he's, you know, White Teeth for Harris, so kind of a transition.
It's a big transition. I mean,
you know, he doesn't work for Cash App or, you know, Block anymore either. He quit.
Yeah, I mean, like, we could have figured out what his stance and politics were a long time ago. Somebody just asked him if he thought Lynn Alden was hot or not.
No, but we just didn't know that was the key.
It's like the silver bullet of interview questions. Well, anyways, thank you for the boost, Miss Hottlenut. Yeah. We appreciate the support, and I hope you have a nice, beautiful orange wedding.
Just not with me. The next one is from Did I 2100 cents. Europeans are not based because the cigarettes they smoke are KYC. I honestly, again, a very simple axiom to identify what's wrong with, well, there's a lot of things wrong with Europeans. But it really, you know, boiling it down to a meme, they smoke KYC cigarettes. That should tell you what you have to know.
Yeah, I mean, I know some Europeans smoke KYC cigarettes.
This is broad. It's a broad generalization to pay here, but generally speaking, Europeans are, you know, Peter McCormack kind of talks about it, like the Overton window of political thought in the United States compared to Europe. It's like in Europe, he's considered like a Alex Jones, right-wing conspiracy theorist, whereas in the United States, he's like called a progressive cuck. In Europe, being a cypherpunk, like that is the rebel. That's like the anarchist in Europe. Like somebody who pays their taxes, but they will still throw a Molotov cocktail because they don't think that their taxes are high enough. Like they want to pay higher taxes. They're like, we can afford higher taxes. We should have to pay them. And that's just, it's weird. It's hard to understand. Their version of anarchy in Europe is like Marxist, which doesn't make any sense. It's hard to understand the European mind. Most of the based ones, they listen to American podcasts. They come to American conferences. A lot of them move to El Salvador. Some are in this hemisphere. But yeah, or Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe's not the same as Western Europe. Eastern Europe is a lot more based, a lot more non-compliant. But it boils down to the KYC cigarettes at the end of the day.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that makes Europe difficult compared to America is it's much, you know, it's very like culturally diverse. So like in America, you know, if you went to like a good government approved school, you know, you grew up saying the Pledge of Allegiance, right? But the European Union, you know, and that's been happening for many years, but I don't think in the European Union they have any equivalent to the Pledge of Allegiance.
That's a good
so
point.
I think there's just like a general confusion of where their allegiance is. You know what I mean?
Right, right. The Europe has been through so many, you know, turns, so to speak, that and they've invited so many new citizens into their country. Who also make they wanted to KYC more people. And now it's like they just don't have the rich tradition and history and culture that we have in the United States. Europe is very high time preference. Mm-hmm. People really don't have a sense of what it means to be French or English or German or Dutch. Like, it goes back much further than the 1980s or the 1970s. They see these like giant, beautiful architecture all over their country, and they don't know who built it. They don't know where it came from. They can't identify with that anymore. And I think that that's probably, you know, part of their problem.
Well, they don't have a constitution.
Right.
And, you know, I think people have to, you know, really respect
American founding fathers. Yeah, they don't have founding fathers.
So, yeah, like people have to respect American culture. So, you know, when the settlers came to the United States, you know, they're like, we're going to clear out all these Indians so that we can build shopping malls and pave parking lots. Right. Right. Like, that's one of the intentions that, you know, Europeans had. You know, they're like, there's too many people here. There's not enough space. They don't have any patriotism. They talk funny. Tobacco doesn't grow here as well as it does in the United States. You know, we're going over there and we're going to get rid of all these Indians and we're going to make parking lots everywhere. Right. And, like, you see this is like a real issue. And I think you tweeted about this last week, which was something about like why LA is a superior city.
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. Another thing to easily identify the difference. So in the United States, if you compare it internally, which is the better than the sovereign city in the United States, the two biggest ones to choose from, New York City, Los Angeles. There's no question about it. It's Los Angeles. And this is a microcosm of why the United States is so much better than Europe. It's because everybody's here, has their own car, and they drive everywhere they go. In New York City, people trust. They don't hold their own keys. You know, they don't have car keys at all. They rely on custodial government solutions like the subway system, the train, the bus, the Amtrak, you know, what have you. In Los Angeles, they don't do that. There's none of that bullshit. They don't have like the wallet of Satoshi bus system. It is, you know, you get in your car and sometimes it costs more money because you have to get gas. Sometimes it takes longer. Sometimes it takes more time to learn how to drive. You have to learn how to drive adversarially in traffic. You have to learn when it is the best time to, if you have to drive across town, you don't go at rush hour. You don't go when the original shitcoiners are flooding the mempool with runes. It requires you to just take more personal responsibility, to value energy, and to value your own sovereignty. Of transport, of moving when you decide that you want to move. Go to Europe. They disincentivize car ownership. Sometimes it's not even illegal. People don't drive everywhere. They rely on KYC. You know, you have to the permission to ride the train, permission to take the bus, permission to, et cetera, et cetera. It's just not a sovereign mindset. Yeah.
Do you know that the Lightning Network doesn't work in France?
Right. Phoenix Wallet. They even built a Lightning node. One of those, like, what, three implementations, major implementations of Lightning, LND, C-Lightning from Blockstream. And then you've got Async. Is that correct, right? Async? The French Lightning?
I'm not even familiar with it. All I know is that when French people try to send Lightning transactions and they don't route correctly, and the transaction fails. Yeah. They just surrender.
Exactly. As soon as the United States changed some regulations about their Lightning, non-KYC Lightning wallets that affected the French wallet Phoenix, Phoenix just raised the white flag. You know, very French movement.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, you can't trust either non-custodial or custodial French Lightning implementations for that reason. But which I think makes it more difficult, you know, because France is one of the biggest economies in Europe and, you know, they're completely off the picture because they just surrender too easily. When things become difficult, they just give up. You know, Lightning is inherently difficult.
Hard money should be hard to use. It's difficult to get a black belt in jiu-jitsu. It's difficult to, you know, become a surfer. It's difficult to win, you know, the UFC title. It's painful. It costs blood, sweat, and tears. But those who dedicate their time and overcome that hardship, that struggle, they're rewarded with things that money can't buy. And that's being a sovereign Lightning node runner. It's hard. It's gonna challenge you. It's gonna make some people cry. Most girls can't do it. But if you're tough and you believe in yourself, you can achieve it.
Totally. Well, thank you for the boost, bit by bit. Appreciate it. The next one is from the Broken Ruler for 1000 Sats, and this person says, what's so special about listening to 40 hours of Bitcoin podcasts? At 1.75x speed, that's only 3 hours and 15 minutes a day. Those are rookie numbers. Enemy of PodConf state, Francis Puglio, says that using leverage to trade Bitcoin to build your stack isn't a shortcut to becoming a real Bitcoin OG. But is listening to 80 to 100 hours of Bitcoin podcasts every week the real cheat code? Sorry, Peter McCormick. If I've only been in Bitcoin for 3 years, but I've listened to every episode of RHR, Rock Paper Bitcoin, and Canadian Bitcoiners podcast, am I accelerating to OG status? How many Bitcoin podcasts do I need to listen to get Adam back to call me an OG? And why does Fountain Podcast Conf Approved have charts for podcasts, but not for podcast listeners? Huh.
That last point. That really resonated with me.
That's a really interesting question. I think Fountain should have charts for the top podcast listeners. We know that Pies would be number one.
Yeah, absolutely. Pies would be number one. But it is, I mean, the listeners or the reason, well, some people might say the listeners are the reason that podcasts are successful. Bitcoin podcasters, they don't care about listeners in terms of they're going to put that content out regardless if anybody's listening. But you're not going to get a boost. You're not going to make money off your podcast unless you have loyal listeners. And I think that having a chart of who are the top Bitcoin podcast consumers gives podcast creators the ability to court those listeners. How do we become a podcast that the most dedicated Bitcoin podcast consumers want to listen to? It kind of creates that value for value feedback loop. Let me generate content for you, and you will in turn boost that listen and boost for the content I create.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, there was a lot here. So I guess we need to come up with like a clear standard for what listening, getting your 40 hours of Bitcoin podcast in means.
You should get badges, like, you know, like gamify it. For every, you get your first 40 hours of Bitcoin podcast badge or some sort of like medal, something in your, you know, like in Call of Duty, you get like a ranking. Your next 40 hours, you can just stack those up. So if you listen to 40 hours a week for 3 years, that's, you know, how many weeks is that? 100 and anyways, it's a lot. It's like 160, 150, 156 medals there just from doing it 40 hours a week for that many weeks for 3 years. And then you could get, you know, one for 1,000. And then if you get 21,000 hours, that's an orange beret.
I think I'm going to tweet this this question: how many hours of Bitcoin podcast do you need to listen to for Adam Back to call you an OG?
Maya, something that's to be considered is you don't want to just podcast adversarially. You want to consume podcasts adversarially. So if you are going to be number one in the rankings for listening to podcasts, you might want to ease in them. Because that puts a target on your back. You don't want everybody showing up to your house, asking you for advice, asking you to show them how to use Sparrow Wallet, asking for you to show them how to like manage their own Lightning node, just because they know you've listened to the most hours, that you have the answers.
Yeah, I mean, like, one of the worst types of advice that somebody can ask you is like they show up at your house. They're like, hey, I know you're an elite podcast listener. Like, what's the best way for me to get you to transfer all your funds from your wallet to my wallet?
Right.
You know what I mean?
And you were just going to be like reacting on instinct, answering this question. And before you know it, you've given up too much information. You just wanted to impress somebody with how deep your understanding of the protocol is. And you revealed your addresses, your private keys. And you made a mistake there, but you realize it before it's too late.
Totally.
I think we had one more here that you skipped. I think that was spam, but they paid us. So thank you, Chad T. I'm not going to say your website that you boosted in the comment because it looks like spam. If I am wrong, correct me in the base to speak. But the last one is from Abile, 801 sats. Kind of like a stable coin. These are kind of like stable coins. They stay the same every week. They grade out and says, stay humble, keep reporting the news, credentialed journalistic integrity. And thank you for that one. We will continue to do that. And thank you for recognizing that's what we do.
I have a sneeze that's like stuck in my nose. So I'm like waiting to respond before that clears. Yeah, appreciate the support, Abile. I might sneeze in the middle of the sentence. I don't know what to do about this. It's really obnoxious. I thought last episode was a pretty great episode.
Yeah.
I think it's just nice. It's really nice to live in a community where there's so many noteworthy people like Natalie and Sam that can... Okay. I already got my first reply on the tweet. So John Osterman on Twitter says, you need to listen to at least 21,000 hours of Bitcoin podcast to be considered an OG by Adam Back. So that might be the standard, but we'll have to see. That's a lot. It's like Orange Beret status.
That's OB, but the question was OG. Maybe John just thinks you're asking about becoming an Orange Beret instead of an OG.
Yeah. Because, I don't know, 21,000. How many hours are in a year?
Let's see. You start getting to like 1.5, 1.75. Speed, though, you start to accelerate the amount of hours you can get out of a year.
So there's 8,760 hours in a year. So let's do some math here. So how many weeks would it take to listen to 40? So 20.
So it would take 2.39 years, 2.4 years really, to achieve 21,000 hours. So that's a little over one cycle. Now, if we do, if you listen at 1.5 though, plus 2, 760, plus 1.5.
So if you were only doing 40 hours a week, it would take you 525 weeks to listen to 21,000 hours of Bitcoin podcast.
At 1.5 speed, if you listen to all the podcasts at 1.5 and you listen nothing but Bitcoin podcasts every day, all day, like I do, it would take you 1.6 years. So you could do it in, you could do it really honestly in just the bull market alone.
I mean, it takes some serious meditation. Work.
Yeah, that's meditation. You know, it's like, there are people who like, at USC and MMA, that'd be like, if you wanted to get 21,000 hours, like BJ Penn, it took him, I think, what, 3 years? 2.5, 3 years to get a black belt. You've got to really be a kind of a prodigy, and B, you got to totally consume yourself in that lifestyle.
Yeah, I think it's unrealistic to expect yourself to be like the BJ Penn of podcast listening. You know, what I mean?
Manage your expectations.
That's a pretty lofty standard to kind of compare yourself against.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, yeah, I mean, that kind of wraps up the show. It looks like that wraps up the show. You got any final thoughts to close? I think this has been a pretty interesting and groundbreaking episode.
Yeah. Something I wanted to get into this week that we've just didn't have time to get into. But I just wanted to say, for all the people in, daytime Bitcoin spaces, they've really been bullying our friend Mars because they think he's retarded. And I just don't, it breaks my heart. Mars is a good dude. He does sometimes seem retarded, but he's not. He's just really passionate about the space. And I just think that the cartels should stop, not just him, but should just stop bullying people in general who are trying to interact with them in good faith. It's fine to bully feds if you don't mind being intolerant. It's fine to bully politicians, but stop bullying Mars. We're bullying our buddy.
Well, yeah, I mean, if there's any, like, belief that he's a fed, he told me that Lynn Alden is hot. So
there you go.
Yeah,
that's one of the first things we asked him.
It's gonna be, mm-hmm. You know, it's one of the most important questions to gauge where somebody's at, and it's gonna be a question that we're gonna be asking a lot more out here.
Anybody who wants to come on this show and be interviewed by us, make sure you have an answer to that question.
Yeah. Speaking of interviews, I'm going to be working through an editing interview with Philip D. McCombs. I'm not posting it yet today because it's going to take some time to edit, but I haven't figured out what I'm going to do with that yet. So stay tuned for that. But that'll be coming at some point. Thank you everybody for tuning in to the Beagle Weekly and for supporting the show, and we'll catch you next week.
Later.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Bugle Weekly. We'll see you next week. So